From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Even in winter, committed bicyclists can be found traversing Baltimore streets. How is the city making way for bikes and improving safety for all? Liz Cornish, head of the advocacy group Bike More, describes the city's new Complete Streets Ordinance, offers an update on the nearly finished downtown bike network, and analyzes the success of dockless scooter and bicycle programs.
People are leaving their cars parked in their parking garages while they're going from meeting to meeting in downtown Baltimore because they have access to these things that make these short 1 mile trips quick, easy, and reliable.
Then Lakeisha Henderson of Bike and Brunch Tours describes the historical treasures to be enjoyed while exploring Baltimore neighborhoods on two wheels. All about bikes on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Want to avoid traffic and sidestep the stress of parking? Looking for a way to work exercise into your everyday routine? Even in winter, committed bicyclists can be found traversing Baltimore streets. And with protected two-way bike lanes on Maryland Avenue and as part of the Big Jump Project connecting the neighborhoods of Penn North, Reservoir Hill, and Remington, there are more ways than ever to ride safely. Here to get us up to speed is Liz Cornish, executive director of the nonprofit advocacy group Bike More. Welcome back to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
So late last year, the city passed the Complete Streets Law, a set of guidelines for the Department of Transportation that focus on safety over speed and prioritize pedestrians and bicyclists to the greatest extent possible. Tell us more about how this law will affect bicyclists.
Sure. Well, I think the most important thing to know about the Complete Streets Bill is it affects everyone in the city. And that was sort of the goal. We have a lot of agencies that do work on the street. And so that could be DPW looking to repair
public works.
That could be the Department of Transportation doing a road resurfacing project. And the goal of any city should be to reduce the amount of pedestrian injury and fatality and reduce the injury and fatality of all road users, including people driving cars, taking transit, and riding a bike. The Complete Streets Bill looks at data-driven ways that we can take advantage of opportunities when we re-engineer streets so that we can improve safety of the people who live here. And we also know that the advantages of designing a city that has complete streets, so that's streets that are designed in a complete way, thinking about not only what's in between the two curbs, but also what do the sidewalks look like? What is the lighting? What is the greenery that supports a healthy street? We know that this leads to increased economic development. And so when you look at all the benefits, the safety benefits, the economic development benefits, this was just the right time for Baltimore City to take that step forward by passing this progressive, exciting piece of legislation.
But you point out that Complete Streets is supposed to take care of all users of the public roadways. Mm-hmm. So are there not still situations where bicyclists could say, this is what Complete Streets expects in this situation, and drivers could say, no, this is what Complete Streets means?
Well, I think that's why we legislated it, so that there is clear legal definition about what does a complete street mean? What does it entail? How do we make those decisions? And so incorporated into the bill, there are a handful of specific engineering guidelines, but most importantly, it's going to task the Department of Transportation to create a complete streets manual that has interagency buy-in, that will go through a rigorous community input process so that every resident in Baltimore City that wants to has an opportunity to weigh in. And then moving forward, it creates clarity. One of the challenges right now in Baltimore City is that depending on who is vocal in representing their community, what agencies set priorities, what city council people are looking at in terms of how capital investments are happening, there's a lot of unequal treatment about how and when improvements are being made. This sets us up for a clear path moving forward, that no matter what we're doing to a street, when we make changes to the street, when we put it back together, it's safer. That means few cars crashing into one another, and that means fewer pedestrian injury and death. And so as Baltimore City, for the last 5 years, we've seen an increase in pedestrian injury and fatality. And so when we know that there's a way to prevent that, I think it's pretty reasonable to say that we need to do that moving forward.
Still, with all the capital needs facing the city, including shoring up decrepit bridges, mm-hmm. building retaining walls, how do you argue that making infrastructure for bikes is a priority?
Well, I don't think we're making the argument that making infrastructure for bikes is a priority over repairing bridges. What we're saying is that the amount of money required to make Baltimore City a leading world-class city in terms of how you travel on foot or by bike, it's minuscule compared to the capital improvements necessary to improve our bridges. There's opportunity too. So we think about the Harford Road Bridge that's currently being rebuilt. We rebuild bridges once every 100 years. So wouldn't it make sense that when we're putting it back together, the Harford Road Bridge, which is a huge priority in terms of safety in the city, that we would put it back in a way that increases somebody walking or somebody biking's ability to do so safely and could potentially reconnect the neighborhoods north of Harford Road Bridge to amenities like Lake Montebello and potentially reduce the amount of car trips people are taking? That seems pretty reasonable. The reality is we aren't. The designs for Harford Road Bridge actually eliminate the existing sidewalk that's there with the barrier. And so what Complete Streets Bill does is it makes that decision-making illegal, which is the type of constraint that we believed needed to be put in place so that we're making good decisions, whether we're rebuilding bridges or resurfacing a road.
Will that decision be revisited?
I hope so, as an advocate. But these are things that we try to make early intervention on. I think we can point to 100 other decisions like that that have been made even within the last 5 years, missed opportunities. The amount of capital investment needed to make Baltimore City a city that where every neighborhood has access to a high-quality bike facility like Maryland Avenue, it's $25 million. 80% of neighborhoods would be connected to a bike lane like Maryland Avenue, reducing both the time that it would take to bike across the city, but certainly inviting more people to do it because people will feel safer. When you talk about rebuilding a bridge or even repairing all of the infrastructure that lies underneath the roadbed in the city that's causing, talking about the steam pipes that make the road surface almost untraversable, doesn't it make sense to do the little things that we can that can improve the quality of life in the short term, knowing that it doesn't deprioritize any of these other bigger investments that we make, but it does provide tangible short-term results for people who live here today?
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Liz Cornish, head of the advocacy organization Bike More, about bike infrastructure and policy in Baltimore. Let me ask you about the Downtown Bike Network. Its implementation was on hold for part of last year due to debate over the fire code. There was a redesign of the network in the spring. How close now is the Downtown Bike Network to being complete?
It's really close. The two main spines, we have Center Street and Monument that's running east-west, and then we have Maryland Avenue that turns into Cathedral and Liberty running north-south. Those are almost complete. Some of them are just waiting sort of a final punch list and inspection to be considered that contract closing out. And then there's some minor improvements to intersection safety. For example, right now, the intersection of Cathedral and Center Street leaves something to be desired in terms of turning traffic and safety. So they're going to redesign that intersection to maybe include additional flex posts to reduce turning speed and create more visibility for people using that. So the Downtown Bike Network as a whole is really close to be completed. And we're really proud of the work that advocates did and that city agencies did to move forward from what was a really challenging year to really benefiting a lot of people being able to get to work safely. I can't tell you how many people, particularly that work at Hopkins Hospital, that are just absolutely thrilled that they can now bike safely to work the entire way. Biking on Monument and Madison Street before was really, really challenging and very scary. And now it feels like a, a really easy and reliable trip to make.
Let me ask you about scooters. Last year, Bird and Lime dockless scooters and bikes descended on Baltimore. These use GPS systems so you can locate them via an app and park them wherever you end up. Bikemore helped write the city pilot agreements for these programs, and those pilots expire in February. What impact have they had on how people get around the city?
Well, the impact, I think, has been bigger than anyone imagined. Let's just talk about scooters, for example. The pilot began in August 15th. Since then, there has been 178,000 users. Now, that means across both applications, so Bird and Lime. So even if every single one of those users was double, you know, registered on both companies, that's at least 90,000 people that have registered to ride a scooter. That's an immense amount of people in the city. And then those users have traveled, the latest numbers show that they've traveled 776,000 miles in a really short amount of time. And what we're hearing from people using them is that all of a sudden it makes getting around, particularly the most congested parts of the city for short trips, so much easier. And people are leaving their cars parked in their parking garages while they're going from meeting to meeting in downtown Baltimore because they have access to these things that make these short 1 mile trips quick, easy, and reliable. And what I think it also demonstrated was that it invited more people to experience the street on a human scale. And what I mean by that is when you're going 15 miles an hour or less using a scooter, it feels really scary to mix with 35 mile per hour traffic. And so you see a lot of people using the existing protected bike lanes that the city's installed, but you also see people riding on the sidewalk. People are always going to choose what makes them feel safer. So for us as advocates, creates this huge opportunity to engage with people that are now having that firsthand experience, that are asking for higher quality infrastructure so that they feel safer when they're using this amenity that obviously there's high demand for. So for us, it's increasing our ability to activate citizens, or there's more people to activate to really force these conversations and to hopefully encourage the city to make these investments quickly and continue to build on the success of this program.
So the pilot is coming to a close. How can residents give feedback?
Well, there is a dockless vehicle survey that's out and available. You can access that through the Department of Transportation website. You can actually access that through both scooter apps on your phone. Every time you open it, it'll start with that dockless link. And then for people that want to connect on social media, Bikemore certainly has been sharing it, and the Department of Transportation has been sharing it. So I think if citizens want to provide input into how the future program will begin to be shaped, that's a really important and good way for people to weigh in. Everybody I know wants this to be safe and successful. So I think there's a lot of different experiences that are going to need to be accounted for. And I know as advocates, we certainly want to make sure as many people that care to have an opportunity to weigh in.
Liz, one of the reasons you advocate for making the city bikeable is to address climate change. Explain that.
Transportation in the past couple of years has surpassed smokestacks. Transportation is the number one contributor to carbon emissions now in the world. And so as an advocate, we look at what are the things that we can do today that will start to chip away at what is a very intractable problem. And the easiest thing that we can do is to get people out of single occupancy vehicles and get them using public transit and get them thinking about other ways to get around city that isn't driving a car by themselves.
Liz, thank you.
Thanks.
Liz Cornish is executive director of the advocacy organization Bikemore. Quick break here on The Record. When we come back, touring Baltimore neighborhoods by bicycle. What can riders learn about culture, history, legacy? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us for that ride on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Outside of well-known museums and beyond wealthy neighborhoods, Baltimore is bursting with historical landmarks that some people never encounter. And touring the monumental city's neighborhoods from inside a bus or car puts a lot of distance between those who live there and those visiting. Enter Lakeisha Henderson, founder of Bike and Brunch Tours. She's found a better way to share Baltimore history on two wheels. Lakeisha, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the mission of Bike and Brunch Tours?
Well, of course, we love to bike and we love to brunch, but really what we aim to do is to broaden the narrative of how people perceive Baltimore City and specifically the neighborhoods and communities in Baltimore City. We want to share the rich legacy, the history, and the culture of the city with those who are here and even greater with those who are visiting the city.
How did this idea come about?
Well, this idea came about as a result of work that I was doing and just time I was spending in neighborhoods, specifically in the West Baltimore area along Pennsylvania Avenue, around Druid Hill Park, Reservoir Hill, and many of the other areas in Upton. And I always had a great time, always encountered friendly faces, saw people playing and just living, and also on occasion encountering the occasional monument and speaking to people who had lived alongside historic figures in our community. And I found this to be amazing. But what I also found to be interesting and amazing was how few people actually highlighted these things when they spoke about these neighborhoods. Oftentimes when I spoke with people who were visiting, people who lived as close as the Washington, D.C. area, even people who lived in adjacent neighborhoods, they had many negative things to say about communities. They seemed to have a level of even sometimes fear about coming to some neighborhoods, which completely seemed to be the opposite of my experience and my narrative and reality. So I wanted to broaden the narrative and broaden the reality and bring that to other people in a way that was more palatable, pun intended, through bike and brunch tours.
So what neighborhoods do riders visit on a bike and brunch tour?
Our tour starts in the Harbor East area, and we bike across the city, uphill at times, across the MLK corridor, and we enter the neighborhood that would be called Upton, the Upton community, which encapsulates several other neighborhoods. And we go as far as Druid Hill Park. We do have two tours. That is our longer tour, which is approximately 10 miles. Sounds a little bit rigorous to some, but it's actually surprisingly to even our less confident rider, something that they find enjoyable. We do have a shorter tour that is 5 miles that tends to stay near the harbor and has no hills. So those are the areas that we cover.
What do you ask people to observe as you're biking?
Well, we don't have expectations of the people who come on the tour. We hope that they tell us what they see, and then at brunch we can have a conversation about those things so that that conversation can be had with people who may not be in their echo chamber. And also, as a result of some of our ride support, we can have people who actually live in the community and who are residents who can also inform what they see and how they understand what they've processed along the way.
While Give me an example.
So an example would be, we pass through some public housing on occasion. During the 70s, some may know that there were arts projects in some public housing areas. So there are some sculptures that people may know about in the city. We have a conversation. We stop and we have a conversation around that. And oftentimes what I find specifically there, and also as we stop in front of Thurgood Marshall's home, that some people have never been in areas where there have been public housing before. On many occasions, I found after the tour that I didn't know that there were people who were not comfortable. And I did not understand at that point why they were uncomfortable, because my lived experience is to come and go throughout all parts of the communities in which I've grown up in. And when we have the conversation at brunch, that comes up. And people then have to evaluate why they were uncomfortable. And when we ask the questions, they actually ask the questions, it comes back to either their personal experience or perceptions about what they think happens in certain places. So a lot of things that happen along a tour, while they're tied to history and culture, they also have conversations that tend to hinge around some of our social biases and even how we're evaluating one another, how we're evaluating space, and how that also impacts the communities.
That's Lakeisha Henderson, founder of Bike and Brunch Tours. Here on The Record on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about taking in Baltimore history by bike. Tell us about some of the local history you share on your tours.
One of the stops along the way I mentioned, which is Thurgood Marshall's childhood home. Of course, everyone knows his story. However, if you go to the corner where the Marble Hill sign is, you'll notice a mural of several figures there, from the founders and leaders in the NAACP to people who, like Thurgood Marshall, have sat on the Supreme Court, to those like Clarence Mitchell and the courthouse that we have. So just looking at that one mural and knowing that all of those people live within blocks of one another just tells you about the activity that was going on in the communities over a course and a period of time. And that just makes me reflect and think of who still remains in the community with those stories. Are these stories being shared? So there are a number of places, a number of stops that we go. And sometimes on the tour, we mix them. But ultimately, we want to show how dynamic it is, from politics, from religion, to people like Billie Holiday and the jazz and the arts in the community.
One of your goals is to inspire and encourage women and people of color to start writing. How do you do this?
Well, I think that I would more so frame it as we want to create a central place where people who are biking, people who want to bike, can come together and bike with one another. So we do this by having events like Maintenance and Mingle, which we do the last Thursday of each month, to create a space that is not on the bike. It's just social. It's something that people aren't concerned about how fast you're riding or what type of bike you have, where they can just speak with one another and find other cyclists who are riding at their level, whether they're training for something, whether it's someone who commutes and wants someone to ride into town with, or whether there's someone who is not quite comfortable with their cycling skills but wants to meet another person to take on a cycling class, learn how to bike.
Maintenance and Mingle, that implies to me that people who take part in your tours bring their own bikes.
Yes. So with Maintenance and Mingle, that is a happy hour that happens in the evening that's separate from our tours. And there we do a brief maintenance lesson on how to be more independent, how to change a flat tire, how to make sure that your chain is in good condition. We even go over some appropriate gear for the winter, summer, small tips and details that help people feel more comfortable getting on the road.
But people need their own bikes to take part in the tours?
So on the tour, people have three options. They may bring their own bicycle, they may rent a bicycle from us, or they may use one of the dockless bike share vehicles. And they all range in prices. Our bikes are available based on availability, but most of our riders do bring their own bicycles.
It's cold. How does winter affect your offering? Do you do tours in the winter?
We are in off season right now. We run our seasons from April until early November. And during our off season, we do still conduct the Maintenance and Mingle. That's mainly to build community for people who are biking here, also to connect people with organizations and individuals who love the city and are actively engaging to do things that align with our mission as well. And that creates a more comfortable space for that to happen. And also, we do pop-up events. So if people want to participate with us in the off-season, whether it be going to yoga classes or going to something like an Afro House performance, they can subscribe and they can join us for some of our weekend fun. Some of us bike to these events, others drive and meet us there, so it's not required. We also do some trips and travel outside of the area and places that are local.
How do you envision the future of Bike and Brunch Tours?
I envision a future where Bike and Brunch Tours has the story of the communities we tour told by the youth of the community and people who grew up in and lived in the communities. So while we currently have people who are either near the community or in the community, that's not everyone. Ultimately, we want to align with more community organizations, more youth groups, more educators and people to create a pipeline so that people from the community, specifically youth, can tell the stories of the community and the legacy and take that experience and build a legacy of their own that allows them to return and build on the culture and the legacy there.
I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lakeisha Henderson is the founder of Bike and Brunch Tours. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to information about upcoming events. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.